And good morning, everyone. Welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers from TC Camp. She's our interviewer. And welcome to Yoel Strimling. He is the first practitioner researcher we've had here in Room 42. He's been spinning straw into gold for over 20 years. He works currently as the senior technical editor, documentation quality SME for CEVA Inc. He's in Israel, and we're super appreciative that he could be here with us. Over the course of his career, he has successfully improved content, writing style, and look and feel of his employer's most important and most used customer-facing documentation by researching and applying principles of documentation quality and survey design. He's an associate fellow from the STC. He's a member of TechCom Israel. He's the editor of Corrigo, the official publication of the STC Editing SIG. And today, he's here to help us start answering the question, what does documentation quality mean, and how do we improve it? Welcome.
Yoel, we're so excited to have you here. You're really thrilled. Now, the first question I have is, I look at your academic background in psychology, and you're talking about quality. What drew you to this topic of quality in communication and documentation?
First, let me thank you for inviting me here, both Liz and Janice. I was looking at the past archives of Room 42, and I'm very impressed by the quality of the people who you've interviewed, and I'm really honored and humbled to be in that list. I would recommend to the listeners now that after this, go back and listen to the other archive ones. There's a lot of great stuff there in the archives. So Janice, you asked me how I got into this from academia. Let me explain a little bit about my background in academia. I have a master's degree in developmental psychology, ages 0 to 5. Mm-hmm. And I started working, because I was at Hebrew University, I started working as an editor for the psychology department, because all the professors were writing articles and things like that. And I was doing my own research piece of knowledge. My master's thesis is actually in the development of personal space in young children. So basically I went and sat too close to little kids until they moved away. Why did I do that? Because I'm always interested in how people react to their environment.
Right.
And because I was working as an editor for the psychology department and being as a psychologist, master's in psychologist in training.
Right.
I was fascinated by the people who read these articles. I read the article, right? And I said to myself, who's gonna read this? it's a well-known joke in technical communication that nobody reads the documentation. We know that's not true, because at least an editor reads the documentation.
Right.
I might be the last reader, but I'm always the first reader.
Right.
And because I'm the first reader, I always saw myself as a reader advocate.
Right.
And that's what I brought when I worked as an editor for the psych department. And I said to myself, you know what? I don't have the skills really to be a therapist. I don't have the empathy.
Right.
That's how it is. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But I said, I really have a feeling for this kind of work, for editing material that will help readers understand what they need to understand or do what they need to do. So I got into technical communication. But because I come from an academic background, having done research myself,
yes,
by scaring little children in the sandbox, I come with a certain skill set that I think is very important for practitioners.
Yes, it is very important. And that's why I wanted to ask you that question, because I think your research is very solid and very sound research. And I think it's that background that you have, even though you're in the practitioner and not the typical person who comes here, it's your research is very practiced. It's very sound research. So what specifically attracted you to the topic of quality?
As I said, because I'm an editor, mm-hmm. I have to be a reader advocate. Mm-hmm. But I can't be a reader advocate if I don't know what my readers want.
Right.
So in psychology and in any other field, people who work in the field should look at the literature to see what's going on. Doctors always have to read the current journals. Mm-hmm. Lawyers always read the cases. What do technical communicators do? well, they read Intercom and they read magazines and they read technical communication, other scholarly and non and trade journals. But I found there was a lack of connection between what we as practitioners do, especially editors, and what's going on in the academic world. Uh-huh. So I said, there's a niche here that needs to be filled. There's something missing. There's often a disconnect, unfortunately, between information consumers and information producers.
Yes.
As information producers, we don't, as technical communicators, we don't have the access we need often, if at all, to our readers. It's weird. When I was doing my research, one of the hardest parts of the research was finding readers who would participate in my study, because I didn't have access. I had to go to customer support groups in different companies around the world and say, hey, will you be willing to send my surveys to your readers? And what's interesting is there's often a policy of not asking readers, customers, about documentation quality. It could be a lack of time, a lack of resources, a lack of interest. But there's a disconnect there, and it was very bothering to me. I said, listen, I can't be a good editor. I can't be a good reader advocate if I don't know what my readers want.
Right.
So
yeah,
pulling on my psychology background, I started looking in the literature, anything I could find about information quality, documentation quality, and I found what's interesting. There's at least 50 different definitions of documentation quality out there. And I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast can think of some off the top of their head right now.
And that was the thing too, is like, well, you know, quality, like I just assume, like, you know, I know what quality is, right? You would assume.
Yeah, see, you know what quality is, but do you know what your readers think quality is?
Right, see, that's the key thing.
We can't ask ourselves, what do readers want? We're not the readers, we're not the right audience.
Right.
And that's one of the other things that I found as well in a lot of the technical communication research on quality is from the technical writer's point of view. Based on, of course, what they think readers want and some research done in the past. But it wasn't enough for me. I said I need to find out what my readers want.
Mm-hmm.
I need to find out. And before you can find out what readers want, if you want to know what readers say is documentation quality, you need to say what quality is in general. What is quality? Quality can be anything. I mean, in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Persig, who used to be a technical communicator himself, said that you know what quality is, but you don't know what quality is. You can't name it, but you can know what it's not. Mm-hmm. But you can't. How do you measure that then? How do you measure quality if you don't know what it is?
Right.
And you know, if you can't measure something, you can't improve it. So if we want to improve our quality documentation, we have to be able to find something that we can use to say this is quality according to our readers. It has to be a reader-oriented definition of documentation quality.
Right.
And of course, it has to cover all aspects of quality, our definition, because quality is objective. Side to it, objective aspects, mm-hmm. and subjective aspects. Objective meaning meets requirements, and subjective meaning meets expectations. Any definition of documentation quality we have has to keep both of those in sight.
Balancing both halves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, were you able to define quality to come up with a definition that's applicable to quality?
Yes, I was. What? Liz?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was. I found a fascinating study by professors Wang and Strong at MIT in 1996. They're relatively well-known research in the field of what used to be called data quality and is now called information quality. Total data quality management, or now it's total information quality management. There's a difference between data and information. I'll talk about that later.
Yeah, there is. And I'm glad you're going to bring back.
There's a big
difference.
We have
to remember to come back to that. Let's not forget. Okay, right. Good.
There's a big difference. And they came up with what they found, an empirically based hierarchical conceptual framework of how to define information quality. And actually, the idea is that their framework for quality, categories and dimensions can actually be applied to any kind of quality. Let me give you an example. They talk about intrinsic quality, representational quality, contextual quality, and accessibility quality, the four different quality categories. Intrinsic quality means information has quality in its own right. Representational quality means information has to be well represented. Contextual quality means that information has to be understood within the context of the task at hand. And accessibility quality means that information has to be easy to find and retrieve. To make this more concrete, I like to give an example of two pens. I have here two pens, a fancy pen, which I got after 10 years of work at my previous employer, got my name on it spelled right and everything. Funny story, previous company I worked at gave me a pen with a company name spelled wrong, which is an ironic gift to give an editor.
It's very memorable.
Yeah, well, I remember it. Anyway, so I have here two pens. This is a fancy pen. It's good, strong material, well-built. And this is a cheap plastic pen, flimsy. I stole it from my boss. Don't tell her. So this has high intrinsic quality, and this has low intrinsic quality. Representational quality. It's a fancy pen. I go to a meeting or interview. I take it out. People say, hey, it's a fancy pen. Must be a fancy guy. As soon as y'all saw this pen, you say, hey, it's a nice pen. And this pen here is dirty, it's cracked. Maybe my boss had it under her couch or something. I don't know. So you got high representational quality and low representational quality. Mm-hmm. Contextual quality. This pen, hold on, my computer is here. Contextual quality. This pen writes well, doesn't smudge, doesn't smear, works well. This pen here has no ink, can't write with it. So this is high contextual quality, and this is low contextual quality. Fitness for use, which is how most people define quality, is a purely contextual idea. I can only use one of these pens to write with, but in theory, I can use both of these pens to clean my ears. Don't worry, I'm not going to, because you should never stick anything in your ear except for your elbow. And then, of course, there's accessibility quality. If I can't find my pen, I can't use my pen, right? So these are the four categories of quality: intrinsic, representational, contextual, and accessibility. Wang and Strong break these down for information into 15 different dimensions. You can look at my published research for the list. I don't remember off the top of my head. There's 15 different information quality dimensions. So my study, what I did, I basically replicated Wang and Strong's study to find out what readers thought were the most important dimension per category. And then I could use that as a way to define documentation quality from the readers. So my research shows that readers define high quality documentation as being accurate from the intrinsic quality category, easy to understand from the representational quality category, relevant, which is from the contextual quality category, and accessible. So high quality documentation, according to readers, is accurate, easy to understand, relevant, and accessible. And that covers everything. Now, that sounds relatively self-evident, but it provides a strong empirical basis for the claim that documentation quality can be measured using a small yet comprehensive set of clear and distinct information quality dimensions. And now that we have this definition of documentation quality, we can use it for all sorts of things. We can use it for metrics. Mm-hmm. We can say, okay, last year we had 5 accuracy issues and now we have 2 accuracy issues. Last year we had 100 easy to understand issues and now we have 200 easy to understand. You know where the problems are and you know how to solve them because everybody knows what these terms mean. When you sit with your SMEs, you can say, okay, we got accuracy issues, we got relevancy issues. These are clear things that readers themselves use to define documentation quality.
Right. So once you can measure it, then you can make the improvement.
If you can't measure, you can't improve it. Now, I know for a fact that there are people who are using this model of how readers define documentation quality in their testing and communication teams. Tom Johnson of the I'd Rather Be Writing blog has used this as a basis for API rubrics, which is fascinating. I really recommend looking up his blog. I don't have the link available, but you can just Google it. It's quite fascinating. And there are other teams, like I said, around the world who are implementing this to see if it works in real life. Because the proof of any research, it doesn't actually work in real life.
Right. It's the application of it from a practitioner's perspective.
Which really emphasizes the disconnect, again, this word disconnect, between academic researchers and practitioners. We as practitioners need to follow the research. But if the research isn't interesting to us or applied to us, it's no good. What's the point of that? There has to be a two-way conversation between academics and practitioners. Academics should be in contact with practitioners to see what is it we're looking at. I did see that an article that there was CIDM did a survey about what academics and practitioners think is important, and there was some overlap, but there were a lot of divergences. One of the things that both academics and practitioners are interested in is user behavior, which of course is what we're all here for. Mm-hmm. Most of us, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think is that the recent study that they, or the recent questionnaire that they put out, CIDM?
Rebecca and Joanne's current new article?
Rebecca and Joanne, yes, correct. Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember the name, but that's I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now people are applying this, and how is that going with people?
It seems to be working really well. It seems to be working really well. Again, this is a preliminary model based on, I mean, my population, my survey population was 81 readers, which is pretty good, good for social science research. Obviously, I want to make the model more robust, so I do need to apply it in real life. I'm currently doing research to make the model more robust using something called the Kano model of customer satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And the Kano model of customer satisfaction is quite fascinating. It's well known in the quality management spheres, also in marketing, if I recall correctly. The Kano model is based on the fact that there are four types of features. There's must-be features, which Jared School likes to talk about the Kano model, the idea of delighting customers and frustrating customers. And the Kano model looks at different features, asks customers, well, how would you feel if it was here? How would you feel if it wasn't there? And then they can plot them into different types. There's must-be types, things that you have to have. And there's performance things that the more you implement them, the better, the more satisfied they are. There's what's called attractive things, which is that customers didn't expect, but when they're there, mm-hmm. even if they're not 100% done, they're really great. And then there's the indifferent things that readers don't care if they're there and customers don't care if they're there or not. I'm applying the Kano model to the definition of documentation quality to see what frustrates and what delights our readers, which is the next step really to say, to make this definition more robust. And right. I'm finding some interesting things. It's only a pilot test, so there's no statistical significance yet. In my original study, there was statistical significance to these things. Because right. this is a pilot study, I'm just testing it out. What I found interesting is, in my first study, readers defined documentation quality as being accurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible. Using the Kano model, they say it's accurate, easy to understand, and accessible, but they say it's more important to be complete rather than relevant. That's an interesting finding, because a document can be relevant, but not complete, or complete and not relevant, depending on the savviness of the reader. A reader may be experienced enough to fill in missing information, but not know if the information is relevant to them or not. Or a reader may know that this isn't relevant to them, but they may not be able to fill in the information. So I'm doing more research on this complete and relevant issue.
Interesting. It's quite interesting. Yeah. So like if an instruction
because if you think, again, it comes down to this.
Yeah.
Documentation is always used in context. Nobody uses documentation for fun, except for me as an editor. And I like reading, you know, so I like reading documentation that maybe nobody else ever reads. But certainly our readers never read documentation for fun. They read it because they want to do something or want to know something. So you always have to see information in context, which is why the contextual category of documentation quality is, it's not more important than the others. If your document is accurate, but not relevant or easy to understand, then you know, no big deal. I like to say there's an infinite amount of inaccurate information out there. Our job as technical communicators is to provide only accurate information.
Right.
But But and to paraphrase Jacob Nielsen, I don't care if it's right, if it's not what I want, right? So it can be accurate, but if it's irrelevant, who cares, right?
Right.
It's accurate, great, nice, thank you. But it doesn't apply to me. So relevance is the idea of personalization. Make it personalized for me. But on the other hand, there's this completeness, which is also a contextual thing. And of the research I did, I found the closest dimensions together were all the contextual ones. Relevance, complete, and valuable. Readers want our documentation to be valuable. And I published this as well in one of the side things, is that what does it mean to say documentation is valuable? Okay, I got relevant documentation, right? Relevant, my document's relevant. A relevant document tells me how to set up a system. A relevant document tells me how to manage my clusters. A relevant document explains the hardware architecture to me. But a valuable document goes beyond that. A valuable document helps me set my system more efficiently. A valuable document helps me manage my clusters more effectively. And a valuable document tells me why the hardware architecture it is and why it's not. So a relevant document helps me do my job, but a valuable document helps me do my job better. That's another interesting side bit that came out of the research. But in the end, the way readers define documentation quality has to be accurate, has to be relevant, it has to be easy to understand and accessible. Like all four of those. If I can't find it, I don't care how accurate and relevant it is. If I don't understand it, I don't care how relevant it is. Like if it's not relevant, I don't care how accurate it is. If it's not accurate, I don't care how relevant it is. These are all four intertwined together. And as an editor, I use this a lot. I use this when I edit stuff. I say, okay, I look for accuracy issues. I look for relevancy issues. I look for easy to understand issues. I look for accessibility issues. Is information easy to find? Is the search working? Are the links working? These are things that, and I know that when I send a document out, after reviewing it for all these four things, accurate, relevant, easy to understand, accessible, intrinsic representational contextual accessibility, I know that my document will, in theory, hopefully, make my readers happy.
And then the feedback that you need to find out from that is the effectiveness of it from a reader's perspective.
That's right. So we also use this model to get meaningful and actionable feedback.
Yes.
We ask, readers are busy people. They don't have time to answer all these questions, right?
No, they don't. So, and they don't appreciate having to answer a lot of questions.
So if you can ask only four questions, could you find the information? Was it accurate? Was it relevant? Was it easy to understand? Okay, you start with yes and no, closed yes and no questions. Was the documentation information easy to find? Yes or no? If no, what was wrong? So you follow with an open question. That's the basic survey design. Try to use the minimum number of questions, use closed questions, and then follow them up with open questions where not clear. And we find it very helpful because because readers understand what these terms mean. And that because we know they're important to readers, they're willing to answer them. And there are only four questions. Was it accurate? Was it easy to understand? Could you find it? Was it relevant? Yes, no.
Right.
And then we can take that information and sit with the SMEs and say, okay, listen, this guy complained that the information was irrelevant. Why was it irrelevant? Oh, because it's the wrong model, the wrong whatever, I don't know, or the wrong audience.
Right.
So we are finding, certainly here at SIVA, where I work, we're finding that it actually does provide measurable and improvable results.
And you're not overburdening your content readers with trying to get a lot of information from them. It's quick and easy for them to answer, right? And then if you take action, I think that's the key thing. You have to take action on it.
Right. It doesn't do any good to collect feedback and not do anything about it. I think it might be worse to collect feedback and then not do anything about it. Like, oh, we care. No, we don't really care.
Right.
Your call is important to us. No, it's not. So we can use this model that's been empirically proven that this is how readers want and give readers what they want. It's a novel idea. Give my readers what I want. And I find because many technical communicators can't contact their readers, they can say, okay, you know what? They can rely on my research. Say, listen, you know, this has been empirically shown that this is what readers want, and they can go to their management and say, listen, we need to focus on this. And it kind of solves the problem of not talking to your, if you can't talk to your readers, talk to people who have talked to readers.
So, okay, you bring up a really good point, because there are times, and it's real, that people don't have access to their readers.
Most of the time.
So, what's that?
Most of the time.
Yeah. So in that situation, then you're saying that talk to people who do talk to the readers.
Right, which is why practitioners and academics have to work together. Because how are practitioners going to find out what readers want? I mean, they're going to, academics often have access to people, to populations, to audiences that we as practitioners don't always have.
Right.
I mean, they can do this study, you know, with, you know, however, I don't know how they get their populations, but they do. They do research about what readers want, and they have access, whereas we as practitioners don't have it. The problem is when you open a technical journal, you got to find something that's interesting to you. And honestly, and I believe I come from the academic world, there's a lot of boring stuff in these journals. No offense to people who do publishing, but I mean, I read some of this stuff and I think to myself, why? Well, I mean, okay, it's very interesting and a very small point, but where's the big picture? How can I apply this?
Right.
Or what's in it for me?
Right. And I kind of want to back up a little bit and point to the fact that, you know, for academics is a different world in that they have time to do a longitudinal study. And when they approach companies to do studies, it's different than you as a practitioner approaching other companies. So I think that's to your point that, you know, all the more reason to have practitioners involved in the early stages of research from an academic's perspective, because they can help guide what is practical for practitioners' perspective, but academics have access that practitioners won't.
Right.
Because like you said, you had to go and contact these customer support departments.
And it wasn't
easy. And I'm sure you hit a lot of walls.
You should see my Excel.
Yes.
Of all the people I contacted, it's like, you know, 3/4 red and, you know, and a quarter green. Yes. On the plus side, the companies who were interested were very interested in quality of the documentation. That's already a plus, that they're interested in improving the documentation quality.
Yeah. And I would also put out there, you know, because this show speaks to both practitioners and academics. If you're a practitioner and you have something that you want researched, reach out to the academics. And see if you can partner with somebody in academics who's doing research, who might want a new research topic.
Right. Twitter is a very good place for that kind of thing. Twitter, certainly mm-hmm. there's a lot of academic technical communicators on Twitter, and they're usually quite open to conversations. I've had a number of conversations with academics and practitioners on Twitter about this kind of stuff. Another interesting possibility is that maybe practitioners could comment on articles that are published and have the responses published as well. That would be interesting, because that would get the practitioners don't have time to do all the research and the literature review and to do my research. You know, I'm not paid to do research. I'm a practitioner, right? So it took me 7 years to do all this research.
Because you're researching on the side, but that has to do with your training too. It's like you're really interested in research.
Exactly.
So practitioners, you have a drive for it.
So practitioners who don't necessarily have the time or the resources or the experience in doing it can certainly respond to, they can send a response to the journal, say, this article is interesting and I wonder maybe we could apply it here, apply it there. They wouldn't need to do any research themselves. They wouldn't need to do any lit review or peer review. They could send a letter to the editor or a letter to the journal editor. Journal editors, honestly, journal editors, technical communication journal editors, I would recommend to them approaching practitioners, hey, listen, let's have a feature where practitioners respond to articles. That would be great, because then the practitioners would feel, A, they'd be published and they could get their needs would be known to the academics, and the academics would also be able to have a conversation. And on the other direction, academics, I don't know how feasible this is, academics could maybe contact practitioners and say, hey, I wrote an article. Hey, what do you think? Let's you know, maybe amplify this on Twitter or LinkedIn or something like that.
Right.
It needs to be some sort of two-way conversation with academics and practitioners.
Right. Well, you know, and hence Room 42, right? That's our goal, to help bridge the gap between academics and practitioners, because academics are very interested in having their work practically applied.
Sure. Well,
like,
done you.
Be clear. They're very interested in having their work practically applied and having their work get results. That's why they do what they do, right? Practitioners really want some good, solid research so that they can go back and say why we want to make a change. Right.
But it has to be research that can be applied.
Yes.
And research that's interesting to practitioners. This article by Rebecca and Joanne showed that both academic and practitioners aren't interested in tools. So that much. So research into tools wouldn't be useful. Research into training may or may not be interesting, but certainly research into content strategy and user behavior and processes, these are things that are there. But as an editor, I'll tell you what interests me as an editor. What I would like to see in more research is how users respond to different modalities of information. Mm-hmm. Meaning a user in this particular field would like to see XYZ in their documentation. A user in this field would like to see ABC, which is one of the triggers, again, for my own research, because I wanted to know what readers wanted. You know, and I also want to know if I knew what readers wanted. I thought I knew what readers wanted. I want to know if it was true.
Right.
I was sort of right.
Yeah, I mean, you can make some assumptions and you can have a general understanding, but you do want to know straight from them.
Yeah.
That feedback straight from the readers.
Yeah.
Because you might be making an intelligent assumption, right? But you kind of want to have that backed up at least once in a while just to check and make sure.
Well, certainly we have tons of communicators that have lots of tools available to us. We have personas, we have use cases, we have journey maps, all sorts of tools that we have to sort of simulate a real reader.
Simulate.
Mm-hmm. But it's just a simulation. It's just a simulation.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's based on data, certainly, I mean, you can't make a user profile out of thin air. You have to do research. You know, who's your reader? Who's your audience? But you get, you know, big picture kind of stuff sometimes.
Hey, let's get to that question earlier that we put a pin in. You said
data versus information?
Yes.
Okay, there's three levels.
Uh-huh.
Let me put it this way. In the information quality literature, there are three levels.
Mm-hmm.
There's data, which is just facts. There's information, which is facts applied to something. And there's knowledge, it's how you use that information to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So data, information, and knowledge are different things. Information helps you connect the dots. Data are dots. Information helps you connect the dots. And knowledge shows you that that's a unicorn or a turtle or something. Okay. To us as practitioners, and certainly I'm seeing a lot in the more modern information quality literature, they're using data information interchangeably. Why? Because they realize that data in and of itself isn't really meaningful. Data quality, right. Is quality a aspect, an objective aspect of data? Data can be accurate. Data can be believable. Not really, because as soon as you look at this data, you're turning it into an information. Because
you change
you're applying,
it.
Yeah. As soon as you look, it's like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You can know how fast something is going or where it is. You can't know both. So as soon as you observe it, no, I'm sorry, Schrodinger. As soon as you observe something, it changes. So as soon as I observe the data, it becomes information because I'm looking at it.
Yes.
That said, information can be both objective and subjective.
Right.
Believable, right? Information believability.
Right.
Do I believe what you're saying to me? Fake news, right? Do I believe it or I don't believe it? That's one of the big problems with medical websites. I am not a trained doctor. So when I look online for my symptoms, I have to believe the information. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but I can know if it's believable. Accuracy is objective. Believability is subjective, right? So when I start to talk about information, it becomes, so I talk about data, it automatically becomes information, which is why the current literature is getting away from data quality and more information quality. Documentation is always information because it leads to knowledge. Because right. Again, documentation is always used in context. As soon as you use something in context, it becomes information. What you do with the information, I think it was Ray Gallen who said information is purely static. Information is. Knowledge is what you do with it. So I think that's a good definition. Data is kind of ethereal. It doesn't exist in and of itself.
Right.
As soon as you observe it, it becomes information. The information is static. What you do with it becomes knowledge.
Right.
And that's what documentation is for. Documentation is for to help readers do what they want to do or know what they need to know.
Right, to inform and instruct. And I think one of the key points that you hit on, and it just stuck in my head, is accuracy. It's like believability is one thing. It's the accuracy is the key thing. And I think that's where a lot of misinformation happens, is a lack of accuracy.
But I can't know if it's accurate or not.
Right.
I have to believe
right.
the information. As a technical communicator, I know that my audience doesn't know the stuff that my SMEs know. They have to believe that it's accurate. But believability and accuracy are not the same thing.
Right.
So to readers, it's more important that it be accurate. Believability isn't as important to readers, according to my study at least, than accuracy is. Believability and accuracy are both intrinsic quality quality dimensions. Right. But accuracy is statistically more significant than believability is. Because it's objective versus subjective. At the end of the day, and that's one of the things I titled my article based on Wang and Strong. The title of the article is Beyond Accuracy. Accuracy is a given. As soon as you say, oh, the information is not accurate, I don't care how clear it is, right?
Right.
In the world of information quality, people say accuracy is the starting point.
Right.
We see though, but accuracy in and of itself is not enough. It has to right. be relevant, has to be easy to understand, has to be accessible. They're all equally important. Believability is above and beyond that. Consider this. Another one of the intrinsic quality category dimensions is objective. The information has to be objective. It has to be even and based. That is, to readers don't care if information is objective or not. They want to know if it's accurate. Accuracy trumps all in the intrinsic category. In other categories, for example, in the contextual quality category, there's complete versus relevant versus valuable. Right. They all vary very close to each other. But it's certainly in the intrinsic quality category, accuracy versus believability versus all the others, accuracy wins all. Because our readers are knowledgeable. They know if it's accurate, they know if it's accurate or not. Because they're right. the ones doing the things or working with the things. Mm-hmm. To a website user, a medical website user, maybe believability is more important because I can't know. I can't know if it's accurate or not. I have to believe that it's accurate.
Right.
That's interesting. Context is important. Like what you just pointed out, I think is like a key factor. And that's because if you're
documentation is more used in context.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
What a great conversation. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, nobody picks up documentation for fun.
Right.
Documentation is not a novel. Nobody, and nobody but me as an editor reads it cover to cover. Readers, somebody once told me we should consider our readers to be attention deficit, irritable teenagers. They don't care. They want to go to information, find what they want, and then go away, do their work. They want.
Right.
They don't. Reading documentation is often a last resort. People are busy. People are tired. They want to go home.
Right.
Reading documentation isn't fun, except for you, unless you're an editor. You know, then it's documentation quality is very important. If you get a focus on those four things, your reader will be very happy. You have made your reader's day. They can go home early and say, oh, I did my job because the documentation helped me. So I saw a meme just this week. 5 minutes of reading documentation can save 6 hours of debugging. And again, it's a meme and it's funny, but there's a kernel of truth in there. If you read the documentation first, maybe you'll know something that will save you time later. But that only works if the documentation is accurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible. If it's not any of those, too bad.
Right.
Or they say in Hebrew, chaval. Chaval al hazman.
Yeah, time is the time to read something that I guess would fall under easy, right?
Easy to understand?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
An interesting finding that I'm finding in the Kano model study I'm doing now, we have a concise. Mm-hmm. Readers would like the information, readers want the information to easily understand, but they'd like it to also be concise. What is concise? Mm-hmm. Minimalism doesn't mean write less. Minimalism means write more concisely.
Get to the
readers
point.
Would like to have information that's concise, but if it's not concise, no big deal, as long as it's easy to understand. I hope to be publishing my Kano model findings, I don't know, maybe another year. It's not so easy because, again, I have a real job.
Well, you know, and good research is not always, it takes time.
It does.
It does take time. It's not something you can just push out right away. You want to get the right amount of exposure.
Yeah. And one of the funny things about research is you can always read another paper, right? As a grad student, that's one of the things that was always a problem, right? Oh, I'll read another paper. You go down a rabbit hole of just reading one paper, another paper. You read everybody else's paper, you'll never publish your own papers.
Right.
And, you know, as an editor, I love reading. So I'm, you know, oh, it's an editor article. And, you know, I got a stack of articles this big. Half of them aren't important. Half of them don't make any sense, but you know.
Right. There we go. So we have one question that I do want to work in. What are your thoughts about video?
Yeah.
And video replacing written documentation? Because that, or at least that always seems to be what the push is.
Right, which gets into that modality question that you brought up earlier, is what mode are the content readers or consumers, I guess they'd be content consumers at that point.
Information, don't use content, information.
Information.
Yeah, I don't, content is a very vague term. Information, mm-hmm. Information leads to knowledge. So producers, I like to use the word information,
okay,
not content.
So how do you deliver the information?
Well, that's an interesting thing. That's not my research. My research is not on how people prefer their information. People want the information to be accurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible. If your video is accurate, if the information in the video is easy to understand, if the information in the video is relevant to me, if the information in context, and relevant, if the information is accessible, then the quality of the information should still be good. But a grainy, I'm always reminded of who was it? Anne Rockley saying once, reused, incorrect, was it? Bad information reused is still bad information.
Right.
It's true. The best, inaccurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible information. But if your video's choppy, or the sound's no good, or it's just a talking head like this, which is really boring, you know. I was at a presentation once. They said, if all your videos are talking head, don't bother. There's no point to that. I can't speak to how people prefer the modality of delivery.
Right.
I talk about information, not delivery. Me personally, I hate videos. You know why? Because they rewind back and forth. Oh, wait, huh? What? I can't do that. I need to have the paper in front of me. Check. I print it out. I'm an old school. I'm a tree killer. I print it out, check. Yeah, I did this. I did that. Okay. I have to read it in front of me. So I can't use videos for instructions. But my opinion would be that if your information is accurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible, then, you know, work on the quality of the video. or
so no matter it. So no matter what modality you're using to deliver information, the quality model stands.
Exactly. That's right. The whole point. How do we define information quality? I call it documentation quality. Documentation quality, information quality, according to readers, must be accurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible. Intrinsic, representational, contextual, accessibility. And just as an aside, Wang and Strong's framework is used extensively throughout the quality management literature. There's been any number of studies done to show that it's really good in identifying and solving information quality issues. It's used ever since it was published in 1996, it's been used lots of places. And it's been fine-tuned here and there. If people are interested, I highly recommend looking up Wang and Strong's original paper.
And the thing is if you want to start implementing this model, you need to find a feedback mechanism, right? You need to create a way to get feedback, correct? Because you have to have measurable and actionable. This is the thing. You want to measure, right? You want to implement, you want to measure it, and then you want to act on that. So are there ways that, what are some of the ways that people could create that in their practice, in their work environment?
Listen, it depends. If you have access to your readers, surveys are the easy way, but they're not the best way. Often, not even close to the best way. The best way, of course, is to sit and talk to your readers face to face. But again, even if you sit and taste, I know people who in training sessions, the users come to the training sessions and then say, okay, let's talk about the accuracy. Let's talk about the easy to understand or the relevance. Let's talk about the accessibility. If they focus on these four categories, these four dimensions, they're more likely to get meaningful and actionable feedback. If you can't talk to your readers and all you have are your SMEs or your manager, you can bring my paper and say, hey, look, research has been done. Let's talk to the SMEs and let's look at the documentation ourselves and mark accuracy issues and mark relevancy issues and mark easy to understand issues and accessibility issues. Personally, I find that when I sit with my SMEs, to go over documentation, it's very helpful to use these terms. They know these terms mean, and they know how to solve them. These are actionable things. This is inaccurate. Oh, why is it inaccurate? Because you put an X instead of a Y. Okay, this is not hard, easy to understand. Why? Because it's written badly. Write it better. Easy to say, write it better. That's my job as an editor. I make it very clear when I sit with my SMEs, they're the accuracy people and I'm the easy to understand person. Together we work as a team to create information quality for our readers. And that actually helps because SMEs who don't really care about readers sometimes say, you know what? That makes sense because me as a reader, says the SME, I also want it to be accurate, relevant, easy to understand and accessible.
Right. So that kind of also helps overcome I want to explain, because sometimes in some situations you run into where a subject matter expert wants a lot of features explained rather than the functions that a user might be interested in.
Right. So then you say, okay, listen, you say, as a user, it is relevant? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, oh, well, not really, no. And you'll say, well, what's relevant to the user? When I train writers, I often say, don't document the tool. Don't document what the tool does. Document what I can do with the tool. Think like a reader. As a reader advocate, that's how I have to think. Mm-hmm. So I said, is this really relevant to the reader? If the answer is no, goodbye, don't need it.
Right.
Liz, I'd like to make a comment. I saw something going on in the chat about usability. I'd like to say something about the term usability. We as tested communicators like to use the word usability a lot. Usability is one of those terms that doesn't have a lot of meaning. Ray Gallen once told me that saying documentation is usable is like going to a restaurant saying the food is edible. It doesn't mean anything. It's documentation usable. What does it mean usable? What do you mean usable?
Right.
I can use it. What can I use it for? I could use it to prop my door open. I could use it to line the birdcage. What does it mean usability? Usability doesn't mean anything out of context.
Right.
Documentation, to be usable, must be accurate, relevant, easy to understand, and accessible. Usability is a vague, generic term that I try to avoid using because usability is too vague.
Right.
Context is missing there. Right.
Right. And we are out of time. What a way to end.
Already? Oh, wow. Oh, I just.
We are. Sorry. Well past, but it's been a really good conversation. So I'm not upset.
Yeah.
And everybody's engaged.
It's been great.
So we apologize for taking extra time, folks, but this was great. Thank you, Yoel. That was fantastic.
And thank you, Yoel, for coming. And the article is fantastic. It's very well written. It's very accessible. And it's very easy to understand.
I hope it's both relevant and valuable.
It is relevant and very valuable. Highly recommend. There's links for it. Everybody should go and check it out. I really appreciated the amount of work that went into doing this, especially considering that, you know, this is not your job to do. And this
well, it is my job. I'm a reader advocate. It's my job.
Well, I mean, the research work, this is like in and above.
That's huge. Right? Yeah.
What you're doing. So in an already busy life.
Yes.
So I really, really appreciate it. And thank you very much for taking the time to come here. Our first international guest.
Thank you.
Very excited.
All right. Great, everyone.